Good evening and welcome to the August 2025 edition of Outbeat News in Depth. I'm Greg Moralia. Well, for those of you who missed our show last month, we announced an adjustment in our format to include more regular voices. Tonight, my co-host Finn Dearhart and I talk with California State Senator Scott Wiener about what we should all be doing to fight back against the attack on our civil rights. Raif DeRozzi will have this month's HIV update, and I'll be talking later in the show with Cade Hansen about his experience escaping an almost cult-like experience in the Catholic Church. It's all coming up next, right after your Outbeat Radio news for the week of August 24th, 2025. I'd love to change the world. This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio news for the week of August 24th, 2025. Earlier this month, a Lithuanian same-sex couple was declared a legal family by a court in Lithuania, making it a historic victory for LGBTQ+ people living in this Baltic nation. The two women in the couple, whose identities have not been made public, were living together and wanted their cohabitation recognized by the government as a form of partnership. The Vilnius City District Court agreed and ruled that the state should create a way for them to register their relationship. The Lithuanian constitution bans a same-sex marriage, and the country's civil code also bans the recognition of same-sex relationships as civil partnerships. Nevertheless, the decision comes after the nation's constitutional court ruled last April that the Lithuanian civil code unconstitutionally limits relationship recognition to relationships that are composed of just one man and one woman. The ruling said that current law violates constitutional principles, including, quote, the concept of a family derived from the Constitution, respect for human rights and dignity, as well as the values of equality, pluralism, and tolerance inherent to a democratic society, end quote. But the rule isn't self-implementing. The Lithuanian parliament needs to pass legislation to create a form of civil partnership recognition for same-sex couples. Meanwhile, lower courts can recognize same-sex couples for some benefits under the law. Some 20 same-sex couples have also petitioned the court to have their relationships recognized. And here in the United States, a Republican bill that would ban all pornography federally is advancing within the Senate. Utah Senator Mike Lee's Interstate Obscenity Definition Act has been referred to the Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation for a review. If approved, it'll go to the U.S. Senate for a vote. The bill would remove the community standards benchmark for determining obscenity and would remove the provision clarifying that sexual conduct must be depicted in a patently offensive manner to be considered obscene, which would label all pornographic content as obscene and render it illegal nationally. The plan to outlaw pornography is outlined in Project 25. That's the 900-page document created by the conservative extremist Heritage Foundation that provided Donald Trump with a blueprint for his second term. The first page of the document equates transgender people and drag queens to pornography, and on page 5 calls for a nationwide ban. This is the third time Senator Lee, best known for his recent deleted social media posts mocking the murders of Minnesota Representatives Melissa Hortman and her husband, has introduced such a bill. It was defeated both in 2022 and then again in 2024, and it's not likely to muster the support needed to pass both bodies of Congress this time around. Proponents of two ballot initiatives in the state of Ohio to overturn the state's ghost prohibition of same-sex marriage and add LGBTQ+ discrimination protections to the state's constitution were given the green light last week to start collecting signatures. The original and ambitious ballot initiative addressing both issues was split in two by the Republican-dominated Ohio Ballot Board in July, in what some characterized as an effort to undermine the two goals by requiring double the number of signatures supporters need to collect to qualify for the ballot. Organizers will now need to garner nearly 1 million signatures in at least half of the state's counties for the two amendments. Backers of both goals were divided on the question of bundling them together in the first place. Ohio's Republican Attorney General Dave Yost announced the initiative's compliance with state law, which allows signature collection to start. He said, quote, this certification should not be construed as an affirmation of the enforceability constitutionally or wisdom of the proposed amendments, end quote. The approved ballot initiatives are titled the Ohio Equal Rights Amendment and Ohio Right to Marry Amendment. The Ohio Right to Marry Amendment would wipe out the state's dormant same-sex marriage ban from the books in anticipation of what some are believing will be the Supreme Court's overturn of the Obergefell v. Hodges decision which provided marriage equality nationwide back in 2015. The Ohio Equal Rights Amendment would update the Federal Equal Rights Amendment, which was ratified by the Ohio legislature back in 1974, and bans discrimination on the basis of sex, and it would add to include LGBTQ+ and other protected classes. It required 3/4 of the U.S. states to approve the Equal Rights Amendment. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia. All right, well, let's get to it. We've got a busy show. Well, hey, Finn, how are you tonight?
Hello, Greg. It's pretty good.
That's fantastic. And I'm excited about our first guest tonight, California State Senator Scott Wiener. He is definitely one of the hardest working legislators I have ever met. And I'm excited to have him back with us to talk about what we should all be doing to protect our civil rights. Senator Wiener, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back. You've been on several times, and we always appreciate hearing from you and being inspired.
Yeah, appreciate that.
I think we could probably talk for hours and hours and hours about all of the stuff that is happening in this country around our rights and democracy in general, but certainly the attack on LGBT people, and it's been hard really to keep up with. I know that one of the things that's been on my mind is about how ICE and all of the immigration actions have been impacting especially trans people of color, and you've been championing a bill to try to bring some sense of identity and justice to this problem with the mask piece. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that bill would do?
Sure. I mean, big picture, like what's happening now with ICE, and when I say ICE, I we don't know if it's only ICE agents. There could be bounty hunters, other agencies. It's very, very unclear, but we basically have what Donald Trump is trying to do is set up a police state and basically a sort of secret police, almost militia style, to try to, and it's a campaign of terror, and it's being inflicted largely on Latino communities. That's if you the fact that there was a court order out of LA from a federal judge ordering the federal government not to racially profile Latino people. We know racial profiling has always happened, but the fact that it's like this formalized thing where they're just grabbing Latino people off the streets, out of front yards, bus stops, work sites, people who are undocumented, but also people who have documents, who have green cards, even U.S. Mm-hmm. citizens. It's a campaign of terror, and it doesn't just impact immigrants, it impacts everyone. For them to deport at the level they are saying they want to deport, which is 3,000 people a day, the kind of police state that they have to build to carry out that level of deportation, it's so massive, and it's going to be so intrusive on everyone's life, whether you are an immigrant, whether you're naturalized, whether you're a natural born citizen, it's going to impact absolutely everyone. And people need to understand that we need to stick up for our immigrant neighbors, but it's not just about immigrants, it's about society in general. And so they're creating this police state, and Congress gave him a $45 billion slush fund, where they're not going to hire, 10,000 new ICE officers. They also have tons of money to open up all sorts of detention centers, gulags, whatever you want to call them. It's a sprawling police state they're creating. And one of the aspects of it is this masking, where we have ICE agents or whoever they are, bounty hunters, we don't know, who are running around basically plain clothes or in fatigues or other weird garb, wearing not just a mask, but extreme masking, approaching like a ski mask, covering up the bulk of their face, and grabbing people and throwing them into unmarked vehicles and disappearing them. We don't even know where they're going. And this is not just, it's terrifying for many reasons, but it also, it tears apart at the fabric of society when You can have some random person wearing a ski mask who just grabs you and you're expected to go. You could have impersonation. People don't know who they're dealing with. They're not wearing any identification, like their name or their agency. It might just say police across their chest. They're sort of impersonating local law enforcement. This completely destroys confidence in all local law enforcement. We want people to feel safe when they call the police. Right. We want people to feel comfortable reporting crimes or being witnesses. And so it's just damaging on so many levels. So it's a long wind up to our bill, Senate Bill 627, which will ban all law enforcement, federal, state, and local, from extreme masking, the ski mask style masking. There are exceptions in the bill for medical masking, also for certain types of activities like SWAT teams who often will cover their faces, certain kinds of undercover investigations. It doesn't prevent face shields like in riot control situations, because you can see through it and see their face. So we're not trying to change sort of longstanding traditional ways of policing. We're trying to address this extreme masking, which, by the way, it's because some people have asked, why are you including state and federal? State and local. Why not just only include federal? Well, this is about all policing. I have serious concerns that if this continues year after year, it will become normalized to see people running around in these ski masks, and you will start to see some state and local law enforcement in certain communities or certain states who start doing the same thing. And we need to nip this in the bud before it becomes normalized and widespread.
How enforceable do you think this is going to be against the Trump administration?
It's very hard. It's hard to enforce it. I don't want to sugarcoat it and pretend like it's going to be easy, but we're not in an easy time. We have some horrible things happening, and it is important to get the law on the books. And maybe at the outset, it might be hard to enforce, but the goal is that over time, this becomes an expectation that people aren't allowed to do this. And we are looking at different ways of enforcement, and we're probably going to make some adjustments to the bill to make it more enforceable.
I think you make a really good point about this having to be applicable to local law enforcement, because while we could look across a state and see lots of examples of how law enforcement is not engaging with ICE, our sheriffs in this state are elected. And all it would take is a sheriff to be elected who aligns those beliefs and wants to engage with ICE and engage his officers with ICE. And all of a sudden now we have local law enforcement wearing these masks and doing the same thing, right?
Yes. So we could see certain local departments or county sheriffs who decide to do this. It's also, when ICE has been asked about the masking, what they will say is, this is not a policy to mask, but if an officer feels like they want to mask or need to mask, we're not going to stop them. You could also see that happening with other law enforcement agencies, just saying, hey, we're going to let people do what they do. I want to be very clear that our state and local law enforcement in California work very hard to try to protect the community. I've worked for years very closely with the San Francisco Police Department, with the California Highway Patrol, a lot of really good people who work really hard. So I really think it's important not to broad brush. I know there are local law enforcement and state law enforcement agencies, including the statewide associations of police officers, police chiefs, who have told me that they're horrified with what ICE is doing, and they think it's absolutely terrible to do this kind of masking, and it makes them crazy that they'll have police emblazoned, police quote unquote, across their chest, because it makes it look like they're local law enforcement. So local and state law enforcement in California, for the most part, are not down with what ICE is doing, and we need to keep it that way. That doesn't spread.
Yeah. On a related note, we've been seeing some stories about, we certainly saw the story in LA about how the president federalized state military personnel, National Guard. He's trying to do this now with the D.C. Metro Police, and then there has been some comments about Oakland, I think he said, in the Bay Area. Wasn't that right, Finn?
Yeah, he mentioned Oakland is on the list of sanctuary cities that he would be coming after. And just curious what your thoughts are about us preparing for these potential. I mean, one thing before that even question, I would say to what you were mentioning about normalization of what's happening. And I speak to so many people who their nervous systems are overwhelmed already. And so when they're seeing stuff go on, they're disconnecting inside themselves because it's so horrible to see the videos that are going around on social media and people. And there are a lot of people that are fighting, but so many people are also just kind of like, I don't know what to do. So it seems like it's brewing a more intensity around here in this area. I'm just curious what people can do to build a broader coalition.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. In terms of like the targeting of cities, and what I mean, I think a lot of people in the Bay Area may not fully appreciate the scale of what's happening in Southern California, where you have like neighborhoods that are like ghost towns. People don't want to go outside. They don't want to go to work. They're scared to take their kids to schools. People are just literally getting grabbed out of bus stops or out of their front yards. It's very, very scary. And I'm grateful that in the Bay Area, we've had issues with ICE raids and particularly around immigration courts in the Bay Area. So I'm not, there have been issues, but it's not at the same scale as Southern California. And I'm bracing myself for if and when it comes here. But they are targeting sanctuary cities. In the latest round, they seem to be going only after cities that have black mayors and large black communities. And they are, you know, with a so-called crime wave that doesn't really exist. And to be clear, we want all crime to go away. And I'm not saying that, you know, crime is not an issue, but they're even in DC where violent crime is down significantly, and they make it seem like it's up, which is just false. And they're doing this to try to rev up their base and this whole, like, you know, I think Governor Newsom made this point the other day that the murder rate in Shreveport, Louisiana, where Mike Johnson represents, is dramatically higher than in San Francisco. And red states have higher murder rates. Red counties, Kern County is the highest murder rate in California, last I checked. And so this whole notion, they try to like demonize cities, and they do it, you know, it's othering people. It's that they're, you know, and here they're really focused on cities with black mayors and large black populations, and trying to scare people and justify this, you know, what at times is performative, and it's really bad. And people, in terms of what you were saying with normalization, I actually was just away for a trip with some friends for a friend's birthday, when I'm with my friends, they're all very attuned and horrified of what's going on. They pay attention. They stay very well informed. People don't want to talk about it. And I get it. It's like you could talk about it and have that be the only thing you talk about. You know, it just is like really bad for people's mental health. and I get that, but it leads to potential normalization. Because people don't want to deal with it. They don't want to talk about it. And I totally understand that. It's horrible and it's traumatic. And we need to find ways to really be very intentional about making sure that people are talking about it. Maybe not all the time, but that we're acknowledging that this is happening and that it's horrible, and that people are involved in organizing against it. Not everyone has to be organizing in every conceivable way, but people need to be mobilized. And I think Finn, you and I were talking about this recently, that, you know, when we had the No Kings protests, that was a huge mass mobilization across the country and like a massive number of communities in every state. And I really thought, wow, the mass mobilization has finally begun. We also saw the mass mobilization in terms of the Tesla protests.
Right.
But now the Tesla protests are, I don't think, are happening anymore as far as I can tell, because Elon is, you know, not in government anymore. He's doing other bad things. Since No Kings, I have not seen the same level of mobilization. And that is concerning to me, because what they're doing is it's sort of nuclear and how destructive it is. And I worry that it's being normalized.
I do too. And I think, like, when I mentioned people's nervous systems, there's like an overwhelmed state that people get to, and they're like, oh, I don't, if it's not in my face right here, right now, I don't want to talk about it, because it's like, what do I do? And I think what I've heard from people is like, it's kind of out of my hands, or I've done what I can, or they call senators and it's like, after that, what? And I think, well, you know, are there like a list of things that people can do at whatever state they're in, their readiness to be participating? There's, you know, contacting senators and representatives, but what else? There's boycotting, there's the protesting, there are labor. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, and different people have different, like, I don't know, the guy in DC, the hoagie guy. I'm from Philadelphia, so for those who don't know, a hoagie is like a sub. Except hoagie's better than a sub. It's the best. And the hoagie guy, you know, he threw the hoagie at the, I don't know if it was an FBI agent, whatever federal agent was out there, and they're now prosecuting him for a felony, as they pardoned all of the January 6th people who were, like, assaulting, injuring or killing law enforcement officers. But he's now, I really hope he does not go to prison. I think, you know, I wouldn't advise someone to throw something at a law enforcement officer, but that was how he was expressing his rage at what was happening. I think we need to find ways for people to channel their rage into activities that are going to help get these fascists out of office. Mm-hmm. and stop them from doing, or stop, slow down, gum up, you know, obstruct what they're trying to do. Mm-hmm.
Another story that's been in the news, I think, that should be on the minds of everybody in our community is the threat to marriage equality.
Yeah.
What's your take on the Supreme Court and their willingness to potentially take on and overthrow another precedent?
Well, we should be very concerned about it. That's why last year we put a constitutional amendment on the ballot in California to remove Prop 8 from the California Constitution and to affirmatively enshrine the right to marriage in the Constitution. We, for years, some people had wanted us to do that. We didn't do it for years because, that's a big deal to pass a ballot measure, and it takes resources and it could divert from other needs, and Prop 8 was a dead letter in the Constitution. But I think as soon as we saw that there was at least a glimmer of energy to try to overturn Obergefell, that's the Supreme Court decision that made marriage a nationwide right, we promptly put something on the ballot and we passed it. So marriage is now protected in California under California law. So no matter, even if Obergefell got overturned by the Supreme Court, we would have marriage equality in California. We, of course, need to make sure that California marriages are respected in other states and by the federal government for Social Security and other benefits. And Congress, a few years ago, did pass a, I forget if it's called, Respect for Marriage Act, or I forget what the name was, by statute, signed into law by President Biden, It requires other states to all states to recognize interracial and LGBTQ marriages, and requires the federal government to honor it. So if Obergefell is overturned, that would be bad, but we would still have this very strong federal law strong law in California. So it would be extremely bad if the Supreme Court were to overturn Obergefell, but it would not be like the end of the road for marriage equality. It's bad, but we have put into place protections in California and under federal law.
Yeah, and that's really good information for our listeners to know as they continue to read all of the the news stories about that. We've got about a minute left.
And I will say that this is one reason why I really wish that Congress had passed a law protecting abortion as well.
Absolutely. And the Equality Act, right? Just to make an even playing field for everything. We've got about a minute left, though, and I guess if we were going to offer one urging or piece of advice to our LGBT listeners about what to do, what's the most important thing you think you could tell people to do right now?
It's important. First of all, it's important for communities to be strong locally and watching out for each other, so to protect our immigrant neighbors, be attuned to what our trans people and their families are going through, and just really being there for each other and having each other's backs locally is incredibly important. Supporting the national advocacy organizations that are protecting all sorts of communities at risk and protecting the right to vote, that's incredibly important. And we need mass mobilization, and we need to have No Kings level protests on a regular basis.
So what I hear you say is find something to do, contribute in some way to an organization and support them, but in all cases, don't do nothing.
Right, exactly.
And do something. Senator, I just want to say, too, I really appreciate so much, and I've mentioned this to you before, your social media presence and the way that you balance out the wit and like kind of the social media attention economy, but also with integrity and how you communicate and the bravery that it's just like sometimes I can't even believe what I'm seeing in the social media space, but you're one of the politicians that I really just cherish the feeds, and I learn a lot from it.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
And your courage. Senator Scott Wiener, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me.
And if you're just joining us, you're listening to Outbeat News in Depth here on KRCB Radio. I am Greg Moralia here with Finn Dearheart. Well, my next guest is Cade Hansen, and I met him on his YouTube channel and was totally impressed by the work he's doing to help gay men who are struggling to reconcile the Catholic faith they grew up with and who they are as a gay person. Cade himself is a survivor, and his story is really fascinating. Cade, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Greg.
Well, we appreciate your time. This is an interesting time to talk about the Catholic Church now with a new pope on board. But before we get to that, you've got a very interesting experience growing up in the Catholic Church and discovering who you are, and then were drawn to serve. Tell us about that.
I grew up in a sort of culturally Catholic household where we went to Mass most weekends. I realized that I was gay kind of in middle school and didn't know what to do with all of that. I was struggling to make friends, make sense of the world. And late into middle school, into high school, I started attending my Catholic Church's local youth group and was making friends, found peace there, loved learning all about the theology and the philosophy, and became super Catholic. I was told that I could be attracted to other men. I just couldn't act on it. And thought that that was going to work for the rest of my life. And then into high school, thought I was going to become a Catholic priest afterwards. Went to a number of different seminaries to look at them, religious orders, applied to become a traditional Carmelite monk, but was ultimately rejected for experiencing same-sex attraction, which was a sort of this awakening moment where I was like, wait, maybe the church does actually have some prejudice against queer individuals. But it still didn't shake my faith, and so I went off to a traditional Catholic college, thought I was going to spend the rest of my life making movies and TV shows and social media posts to help promote the Catholic Church, was super, super deep into the Catholic Church, praying every day, had this relationship with Jesus, praying the rosary every day, like, was all the way in. And then at age 20, I dropped out of college for business reasons, was looking at the rest of my life, and I was like, do I have good reasons to say that I can never fall in love, that I can never go on dates, that I can never hold hands? Realized we didn't really have good reason to think that. Looked at the other Catholic Church teachings and then left about 2 years ago. And then started this YouTube channel about a year or so ago to take a kind of a critical look at some of the teachings of the conservative movement within the Catholic Church.
You've had quite a journey, and you looked at different orders. For our listeners who don't know what an order is, I mean, there is, like in politics, liberal interpretations of the Catholic faith and very conservative. Can you give us a little bit of an overview of the different orders and what you found?
Yeah, so the Catholic Church is an incredibly complex and diverse institution with over a billion people that would kind of label themselves as Catholic. And so there's both sort of like liberal or conservative factions within the church. And there's a whole bunch of different ways to look at that issue, specifically with orders. Kind of an order is a sort of group that likes a particular element about the Catholic faith. So there's a group called the Dominicans, and they're the Order of Preachers, and they're big on sort of learning theology and philosophy and in academia. And then you have sort of the Carmelites that I was looking to join, which have this deep root in focusing on contemplative prayer and silent prayer in these monastic groups. And then you have other groups that sort of have different emphases of how they see the faith. You see friars out in New York. There's groups that focus just on helping mothers who are considering abortion, and they're big on sort of the pro-life side to the Catholic Church. Each of these different orders has a different like charism, a different schedule, a different way of looking at the church. And then within all of those, then even within those kind of orders, then there's ones that are more theologically conservative, or others that focus on silence in monasteries while others are out in the world doing work. So there's a number of different paths to go down when it comes to vocations and being a priest or a monk or a nun in the Catholic Church.
And all of those orders fall under the direction of Rome and the Pope, right?
That's one thing about the Catholic Church, that everything comes back to Rome. The Catholics pride themselves on anytime there's sort of questions or disagreements, there's a kind of final authority to settle all of these issues. There's a lot of things to be said about there are legitimate issues within the church and things that people disagree on in mutually exclusive ways. But all of these different groups have different authority structures that go all the way up to Rome, which means some of these groups will just be taken out of existence by the Pope at times, or the Pope can make new ones, or any sort of these decisions made at local levels are subject to review from higher ups in Rome.
And in one of your podcasts on your YouTube channel, you talked about the Carmelite experience, I believe it was, and you described this as a cult. What did you see that was cultish about that?
Yeah, so I think the term cult often people use the word cult differently. I like to kind of use it as a sort of replacement term high control, looking at the BITE model, which is sort of like, is this a cult checklist, so to speak? There's through the BITE model, you can apply it to the military, you can apply it to different like high control like sales teams out there, you can apply it to religion. And so with this particular Carmelite group that I was looking at, some of the big sort of red flags for a cult is that your family can come to visit you occasionally, but there's a sort of what sort of looks like jail bars in between, where you can't really hug your family or go to the outside world, and they're discouraged from seeing you. That all communications are monitored inbound and outbound, that you're not allowed to physically leave the property, that you are in contemplative prayer or doing free manual labor for this particular group for forever, that you can't deviate and must always back up the group in legal proceedings, were sort of the red flags for it being a cult.
Wow. That sounds terrifying to me.
Yeah, that's the thing about monastic life, where it's a beautiful thing. I loved spending all of my days in prayer, and following the liturgical calendar, and praying with interest in silence and reading the scriptures. And so the idea of going to a monastery sounded like beautiful, because it was just focusing on God. There's the saying that a group like that, the veil between heaven and earth is so thin that angels sort of walk among the monastery because they are completely silent almost all of the time, which is a beautiful thing. But in the value of the BITE model is that it's sort of value judgment free, right? Like where you want the military to sort of be a high control institution, it wouldn't work if you could leave at any point. And so with this group, you can both see the signs of it being a cult and also see the beauty in it. The BITE model sort of shows people gives people sort of a heads up on what they're getting into, or tools to help figure out, like, is this something I actually want to do? Is kind of the value there.
Interesting. Well, I know for me, I think I shared with you before, I grew up in the Catholic Church. I was an altar boy. I was confirmed. And when I realized I was gay in about seventh grade, I never really heard any messaging around it being wrong. There wasn't really anything for me to reconcile. That came later. And I would imagine for you, you saw the same hypocrisy or discovered the same hypocrisy that I did when I read about the child abuse scandals, when I read about the number of gay clergy. And then when I heard the Pope talk about me being intrinsically disordered, and this idea that, well, you can come to our church, but we're not going to accept you for who you are. I got a real sense of second classism. What was that experience like for you when you sort of started to see all this?
Yeah, so before I became super Catholic, late into middle school, early into high school, what I heard about what the Catholic Church had to say about homosexuality was sort of, Pope Francis is updating the rules. I think most sort of vaguely liberal Catholics or Catholics at an average parish don't hear these sort of hard-hitting teachings that homosexuality is wrong, oftentimes because priests know that either the priests themselves are gay and don't want to talk about it, or they kind of go, hey, like I love God and don't want to hurt other people, and I know that preaching about this would hurt other people, or the church is looking to update on this issue, whatever it is. So growing up, I didn't feel like this sort of second-class citizen. It wasn't until I started taking my faith seriously, so to speak, and was reading all of these older theology books and philosophy books, and then all of these people that had never said anything about homosexuality all of a sudden sort of like revealed these teachings. And I was like, did you guys think this all along about me? Like before, did I not get the memo? And what I found to be the difficult part is that in this new wave of Catholic teaching, especially conservative people's post into the 2000s, I've tried to sort of workshop this teaching to make it more palatable, to make it make sense. And on paper, they sort of have this easy way of looking at it, which is, your beloved son of the father who experiences same-sex attraction, your identity is, or your experience is not your identity, that we love you so much that you don't have to act on these same-sex attractions, and you can be a full member of the church, being attracted to men, you just can't act on it, and Jesus calls us to holiness and to happiness. Which sort of to like a straight Catholic makes sense on paper, right? There's no big issues. It just sort of, yeah, it might be culturally unpopular, but like people are still going to be happy. And so when I was going through my teenage years, it was like, hey, this makes sense on paper. Everybody's telling me that I'll be just fine being celibate. And then it was kind of that turning point when I was 20 and realized like maybe this kind of works on paper, but not in reality. That maybe you can't separate your experience from your identity. That maybe not even being able to use the term gay and just same-sex attracted all the time, maybe that doesn't work. And like the idea of mandatory celibacy, like maybe God has something in store for us more than just wait around to die and then be rewarded in heaven. And I think this is the big sort of cultural shift where when I was in the church, I had to make the church teaching work, had to like do all the theology and philosophy. And now since leaving, I can just look at the world honestly. And so we're looking at problems inside of the Catholic Church, so the pros and cons of various teachings, or the reality of these teachings, like on the ground. I can look at and investigate and hear people's stories versus trying to make it all fit into sort of a tight little neat box on paper.
Well, I think a lot of gay men and women struggle at some point. If they grew up in a faith tradition and then realize who they are, they go through this reconciliation process, and tragically, they're forced to choose either faith tradition or who they are. How did you finally get the courage? I don't know if courage is the right word, but how did that finally happen for you? What were there some tools or some things that made you be able to make that decision to reconcile yourself and move forward? I don't know if I'm describing that right.
Yeah, so I dropped out of this conservative Catholic college, and I think going there was the start of sort of rattling my faith because I finally saw what is Catholic teaching like on the ground. Where like growing up in sort of like a liberal Western suburb of Minneapolis, socially liberal, that it was easy to sort of like look at the world around me and criticize it and then have the sort of this panacea to the world's problems, where if everyone around me finally followed Catholic Church teaching, the world would be a better place. But it wasn't until I went out to this Catholic college that I finally saw that all of the solutions on teachings on sexuality or government or how to raise kids or all of these things, like they made sense on paper. And then I finally saw people who were raised with 14 siblings and the mom had terrible health scares because she didn't have access to contraception. And I was talking to other people who experienced same-sex attraction and were deeply harmed by the church's teaching. And all of these sort of like, it was sort of seen, I was forced to confront the reality of these teachings. And then after I dropped out, I had 6 months of kind of being on my own with other Catholics. Wasn't as involved in going to church 24/7, and kind of looked at this issue where I went for the rest of my life. I can't become a priest or a monk. I was told I can't do that. Obviously, getting married isn't going to work. So I'm going to be celibate the rest of my life. And it's easy to be celibate in high school because a lot of people aren't dating or people are figuring things out. And like from the time that I'm now 20 all the way until I'm 80 or 90 or whatever it is, I'm never going to be able to fall in love. I'm never going to be able to hold hands, to go on a date, to raise kids, to build a life together. And so I went back through all of these books that I'd read on philosophy and theology and church apologetics. And I was like, they're asking something big of me and they should have really good answers. And reading everything back through, it was like, oh, like they sort of, they have an answer, but I don't think it's a good answer. It's sort of like if you go to court, there's times where somebody will make a crazy legal defense. And you're like, well, technically, could everybody who's looking at this case be lying and every piece of evidence was fabricated by the Illuminati? Like, sure, like technically that works, but like that's not a very compelling reason. Like the evidence seems overwhelming against somebody. In this case, when I was looking at Catholic teaching on why I could never be gay, I was like, oh, there's some sort of like Aristotelian philosophy that kind of makes sense, or maybe some statistics. Like at the end of the day, maybe it kind of got me like 10% of the way to confidence. And so looking at this issue, I was like, if I want to have beliefs match up to my evidence, then the Catholic Church is wrong on this issue. Right, like the Catholic Church has answers, and I don't find them compelling ones. And the hard part about the Catholic Church, at least the branch that I was in, is it's all or nothing, where the church is right on everything. And so for me to break from the church on this one thing meant that I had to leave the group that I was a part of. And so I spent kind of 6 months as a mere Christian, trying to figure out like, do I want to go to church at all from these other churches that are a little bit more accepting? And then kind of left religion altogether by the time I was getting closer to 21. And now I've sort of rebuilt life without religion. Going to church someday is still something that might be in the cards. I'm not totally closed off to it. But I couldn't find a way to harmonize my sexuality in the Catholic groups that I was a part of. But now, sort of on the other side, making content, I find it amazing and super needed that there are voices from inside the Catholic Church saying that you don't have to decide between your culture, your family, your friend groups, your spirituality, your relationship with God, and your sexuality. So incredibly grateful for those people, and wish the group that I was a part of in the Catholic Church could have should have had that as an option on the table.
So in this journey, have you looked at any other similar faith traditions? I'm thinking about the Episcopal Church, for example. For me, it's been very difficult to find anything else that I would find credible based upon the teaching experience and the learning experience I had as a young person. Have you looked at any others, or have any other faith traditions resonated with you?
I visited a number of different churches, and sort of religious groups that are out there that are also affirming. And I haven't found them particularly compelling for where I'm at. The hard part is that having studied theology and philosophy formally, having been so Catholic and studied apologetics and read pretty much every book on the shelf in a certain sense. The times that I have gone to affirming churches, I tend to sit there and have like eight different like voices on my shoulder from like various different faith traditions and in the Catholic perspective and the liberal Catholic perspective and other religious perspectives and in the agnostic perspective. And I think one day, if I ever were to go back to church, I would have to find a way to sort of turn off the theology and philosophy nerd side of my brain. Because even if I go to a Catholic church, I kind of sit there like analyzing the whole thing. And so I haven't found any of those compelling yet. I have visited, I have friends that attend and have wonderful things to say. But I found like the way that I saw faith was with certainty. And so this whole sort of the enemy of faith is certainty, or these more exempting and liberal factions within the church that are much bigger on mystery and transcendence. I'm so unfamiliar with approaching God and spirituality in that way that I kind of sit there and I'm like, oh, like I just couldn't picture myself saying the I believe statements around this because I was told that belief is sort of certainty, and I thought that I could prove all of these things. I find it difficult to sort of reconcile the two. And also being living in Colorado, I'd rather spend my Sundays deep into the mountains than at any particular church.
That's a beautiful state for sure. So, if you were going to sum up the Catholic Church's current stance on gay and transgender people, how would you describe it?
According to the Catechism, which is a sort of the like list of official Catholic Church teachings, the stance on gay people is essentially that we don't know what makes people attracted to the same sex, but regardless of it, people can never ever act on it, and that attraction is intrinsically disordered, which means that it can never lead to life. It can never be. People can never get married. Like, it is so far off the table in how the Catechism looks at this issue that there is no room to budge. And then on trans issues, the funny thing is that the Catholic Church has never really formally taught on this issue. That sort of all of the transphobia that the church experiences is kind of an offshoot of condemning homosexuality, where if you say like two men can never get married because of the biological functions, then somebody who experiences gender dysphoria and socially or medically transitions, then we can't allow that because then it would sort of be gay in a certain sense. And so there's a number of Catholic documents that quite harshly condemn trans people and say that they just got to be sent to counseling to stop being trans, which, as we know, doesn't work and doesn't lead to great outcomes. And so those are kind of like the official stances by Rome. But often I see in Catholicism there's Rome and then there's the Catholic Church. What I mean by that is that like Rome has a lot of teachings on a lot of different things. And when we look at the statistics and we look at the church across the world, people don't perfectly follow those, and nor has Rome always been in control of those. And so within the church, or I should say among people who consider themselves part of the church, there are a number of progressive and amazing movements where I think you can pretty clearly make the case that if God is all loving and wants the best for us, then people being able to socially and medically transition, people being able to marry people in long-term committed relationships and adopt whatever it is, see brilliant and life-giving things according to any sort of God metric, so to speak. And so on the ground, Catholics, individual Catholics aren't often very homophobic or transphobic, that there are people within the church that are making queer individuals feel welcome. But unfortunately, still, the official position from Rome is that these can never be allowed, that if these are ever allowed or people engage in them at all, they will go or are liable to go directly to hell for any reason, no matter how beautiful a gay marriage could be.
Well, Pope Francis was hinting at some change around that. Now we have Pope Leo. From what you've seen and what you've read about him, what are your thoughts? What direction are we going to be moving?
Yeah, I'm incredibly grateful for how Pope Francis has kind of changed how the church talks and looks at this issue from a social perspective. Where in previous administrations, so to speak, or with previous popes, the LGBT issues were looked at very harshly, that people used incredibly derogatory terms, but there was no sort of compassion for people going through this experience. And what Pope Francis did is sort of pay lip service to the LGBT experience, but ultimately Pope Francis didn't change that much. He still barred gay men from entering the priesthood. He still said that gender ideology is the work of Satan. Like he kept all the same teachings, but I'm grateful that he sort of like softened the language that the church uses and to recognize the harm that this can often do. With Pope Leo, though, so far what I've seen from Leo and my general prediction is that Leo's not going to rock the boat in either direction. Where before Pope Francis, there was Benedict, and he was very conservative, moved the church in a very conservative direction. Pope Francis did the opposite direction and kind of made the church a lot more palatable to the outside world, looked at a number of liberal causes. From what I've seen on Leo's background and from what he's done so far, so it seems like he's going to be sort of a moderate, business-as-usual type of pope. He hasn't pushed too many boundaries in either direction. And so I think both progressive Catholics and super traditional Catholics are going to be relatively disappointed by him. At least that's what I've seen so far.
Mm-hmm. Well, your work is fascinating, Kate. Tell our listeners where they can go to follow you. You have a YouTube channel and you have a podcast.
Yeah, so my main channel is, if you look up Kate Bradley, or the handle is GayXTrad. It's a YouTube channel, also available in podcast form and on Instagram, TikTok, all that jazz, which has sort of my original thought pieces on Catholicism. So I have sort of response videos to some of these conservatives within inside of the church. I have videos on my own experience, some general critiques of the conservative Catholic movement, and different videos on how to come out and what life is like after leaving the church. And then I went a podcast called Intrinsically Ordered. That's on all major platforms, Spotify, it's on YouTube, it's on Amazon, it's on Apple Podcasts, which is sort of a much more diverse platform where I have on a number of different guests that are still in the Catholic Church and have great things to say about that the Catholic Church can change on this issue. I have people that have joined other groups with inside of Christianity and found peace there. I bring on some different psychological experts or philosophical experts or my friends to elevate it and show how diverse of an experience all of this is. And the podcast name is sort of an inversion of what the Catechism says, which is same-sex attractions are intrinsically disordered, and that's what people hear growing up, that you or your attractions are intrinsically disordered. What I think I want to show people is that there are options out there, that these attractions are good and can be life-giving. And I say with all of my work that my goal is not deconversion, it's de-radicalization. Like whether somebody joins the church or leaves the church or moves to a different church, like I don't tell people what to do on that end. All I want people to know, whether they're gay and Catholic or wherever they are, is that they have options, that they can think through these issues, and that they are perfectly fine to make a decision about where they want to be, and that somebody in Rome doesn't know your life better than you do, and what is going to bring you fulfillment and relationship with the divine.
Fantastic. Kate, thank you so much for spending time with us. We'll have all of those links that you just mentioned on our website at outbeatnews.com. Just go to the top of the page and click on show notes, and you can follow Kate's work. Thanks for being with us. And that wraps up our hour. Be sure to tune in next Sunday night for Outbeat Radio with Del Phoenix. That's at 8 p.m. and only here on KRCB Radio. In the meantime, have a great week, and thanks for spending your Sunday night with us. Outbeat News in Depth is hosted and produced by Greg Moralia. Our shows are available for on-demand play anytime on our website at outbeatnews.com and on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, TuneIn, and now on iHeartRadio. Find links to subscribe at outbeatnews.com. I'd love to change the world, but I don't know what to do. So I give it up to you. You're broken down and tired.
on the merry-go-round. And you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains. We gon' walk it out and move mountains. And now silence is a quiet, and it feels like it's getting hard to breathe. And I know you feel like dying, but I promise we'll take the world to its feet. Move mountains, bring it to its feet. For that we have each other.
Support for Outbeat Radio on KRCB-FM comes from listeners and from Rocky, the free-range chicken, and Rosie, the original organic chicken. Air-chilled, non-GMO, locally raised right here in Sonoma County with no antibiotics ever. More information is available at rockyandrosie.com. You're listening to 104.9 KRCB-FM Roanoke Park and KRCG-FM Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station. It's 9 p.m. Stay with us. Le Jazz Hot is next.